You're listening to the GP Supervision Australia podcast, Managing Uncertainty, presented by Dr. Gerard Ingham and Dr. Simon Morgan. We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which this recording was produced and pay our respects to their elders past, present, future, and their families.
We've got a very, very interesting session. It's such an important aspect of practice as GPs and what we do, and a very, very important element of our role that we need to think about teaching registrars. And I think a hard one. It's tricky. It's difficult to know how to instill this into our registrars. So my name's Simon Morgan. I am a GP, I'm a medical educator, and I'm coming to you from a Awabakal country in Newcastle. I would like very much to hand over to my friend and colleague, Gerard Ingham, who normally resides in Victoria, but is now up in the top end. Gerard, lovely to have you along.
Yes, thank you. I am in Katherine. This is, as Simon said, a very important topic. I'm going to set out at the start some learning objectives for the session. I want to spend some time explaining how low pretest probability of disease in primary care impacts on how uncertainty is managed. I want to teach, or perhaps just remind you of some consultation techniques that aid in the management of uncertainty. Remind you again of Murtagh's safe diagnostic model to explore uncertainty, but particularly to introduce you to a new model, which is called the 3 R's of management model, which is another way of exploring uncertainty. Rather than looking at the diagnosis, the dilemma of what's the diagnosis, it looks for the dilemma of what management be in this uncertain situation. So, you know, managing uncertainty is important. It's often said to be the art or special technique of general practice. You can read many articles that talk about this is something that GPs do more than other clinicians. I mean, obviously, as primary care physicians, we have to sift through all the presentations that come to us and make a diagnosis and often decide what to do. And often there is a degree of uncertainty. I put it to you also that there's probably even more uncertainty in their practice for registrars as they go through their days. Things that you might think are quite certain for them are very uncertain. And so they're likely to bring those dilemmas to you. It's also important because this is one of the components of being a general practitioner that is part of one of the 10 assessed competencies in the RACGP assessments. And importantly for supervisors, it's the thing that they can't learn by reading about it. It's one of the reasons why we have an apprenticeship model of GP training is you really need supervisors, you, the masters of general practice, to help them learn to think and act like a GP. There's actually no universal definition of what is uncertainty and what its components are, but there are lots of things talking about how to teach the management of uncertainty. How do you teach a registrar to make the secret sauce, to be able to manage uncertainty well? The 4 things I'm going to go over with you. One is the importance of making the unique GP paradigm explicit. Secondly, to normalise the presence of uncertainty. Thirdly, to teach consultation techniques that help manage uncertainty. And 4, as I mentioned in the learning objectives, to consider, to guide reflection on uncertain circumstances by going over diagnostic and management options. And with GPs and hospital doctors, we can see a patient, but we will see things differently. What the hospital doctor will see when faced with a clinical circumstance will be, and a patient in front of them, will be different from what a GP sees. Neither of them, and how they act in response to how they see it, is different. Neither of them are inappropriate in the context. One is not superior to the other, but each are appropriate to the context. And I think this sort of battle between who's doing it the right way, we just need to abandon that, but appreciate that they're appropriate in each circumstance. It can be hard, particularly for a doctor coming out of hospital, to see it the other way, to see it like a GP sees it. And so how do we help people to see the features of general practice, the things which are different and unique about our approach? What are the unique features of general practice approach to patient care that are different from hospital care? We have more time, holistic, whole care, time and asset longitudinal, earlier presentations, continuity, all these things. Systematically, we're not just focused on one particular area. So you can see all those things which are different. Patient-centered, relationship-based, holistic. Often a diagnosis can't be made. We often don't make a diagnosis. I'll talk more about that later. Care is provided over time. Another feature of us is that we're cost-effective. You know, we don't order an MRI on everything that comes through the door. I really like this quote. I came across this. General practice trainees are often taught the truism that in primary care, they learn by encountering different illnesses in the same patients, whereas secondary care specialists learn from seeing the same illness in different patients. It's also true in general practice. We will know our context and what we're likely to see and what's the experience and what our community is, and we'll do it. The other thing I'll point out about general practice, as I was saying before, often it's said somewhere between 30 to 40% of new presentations coming to general practice, we won't achieve a formal diagnosis. It'll be something strange. We won't achieve a formal diagnosis and it will go away. Given this different paradigm, I'm going to explore why it is that we behave differently when faced with uncertainty. In hospital, they will keep ordering one test after another, after another, after another. You know, everyone must leave on the discharge summary, must have a diagnosis, whereas in general practice, we'll tolerate this uncertainty of no diagnosis for longer. Why is it that we don't keep investigating? What's the science behind it? It's down to Bayes' theorem. It's all to science. So let's explore why. This may not be uncertain for you, but this would be a typical uncertain scenario brought to you by a registrar. They say, you know, this is, I'd normally order a troponin for this circumstance in hospital. I want to discuss whether we should order a troponin in this circumstance, because in hospital, anyone who comes in with chest pain get into emergency department gets a troponin and then gets it repeated after X number of hours. So this example, I'm just going to go over it slowly because we will visit it again a few times. It's a 75-year-old man, Steve, and he presents to your registrar with left-sided mid-thoracic and chest pain that's sharp but lasts only seconds. It's been happening intermittently for 3 weeks and is brought on particularly when he twists or is leaning over to do the dishes. It is sharp and resolves shortly after changing position, but he has no chest pain on exertion. He walks his dogs around your hilly town every morning without pain. Stephen has no history of fever, cough or wheeze, no risk factors for pulmonary embolus or for ischemic heart disease other than well-controlled hypertension. He looks well, he examines well, there's no rash, and an ECG taken by a nurse before you could tell her not to do it is normal as well. Given that circumstance, based on this history and exam and ECG, what do you think is the chance of Stephen having myocardial ischemia as a cause of his pain? It's 1% or less, and a few are saying 2 to 5%. And I'm guessing, and given that, it's probably on the lower end. So let's go through Bayes' theorem and explain why it is that we don't, why ordering a test in this circumstance is bad medicine, bad science. Not, it's not the art of general practice, it's the science of general practice. Okay, so I've looked up some papers to find out what the sensitivity of highly sensitive troponin is at age 75 and what the specificity is. Don't ask me to explain Bayes' theorem, but I am going to use it. It has something to do with the combination of probabilities. It's the science, it's the math behind what we, this decision which you're making here. I'm using a spreadsheet which was shared with me by medical educator called Mark Burgermeister. But basically, if I go through this spreadsheet, it calculates the outcomes of tests when we know the sensitivity, the specificity of the test, and the likelihood of disease. You think it's a 1% or less, because it's a 1% chance of the person having the disease. And so this brings us to a thing called the positive predictive value or the false positive proportion of positive tests, which is another way to say it. In this circumstance, if you get a positive test, it's way more likely to be false positive. 96% of positive tests in this circumstance will be false. So a positive test in this circumstance is usually not right, by a big margin. If it was 5% and we got down to 80% false positives. So let's look through this then. So let's look at the decision we're making here. So if Stephen's test troponin was positive, it's most likely a false positive, 96% likely to be false positive based upon the maths. Having got that positive test, he will then have an investigation cascade. He'll have a coronary angiogram. Okay, there's probably a 1 in 1,000 risk that he'll have a stroke and with his coronary angiogram, and it will cost $5,700. That's the Medicare rebate for a coronary angiogram from ordering that test. He'll end up on 4 medications, an aspirin, a statin, a beta blocker, and an ACE inhibitor that he may not need. He might get hypertension from that and fall over and do a NOF. He might get bleeding from his aspirin. He might get aches and pains from his statin. He might feel slowed up from his beta blocker. You will have given him the diagnosis that he's got ischemic heart disease, even though he doesn't, 96% likely that he doesn't. And that'll have psychological impacts. He might restrict his exercise, doesn't want to risk having a heart attack when he's having sex. He decides not to travel because it's too risky going to other places. And he may have health anxiety and become depressed. So they're the outcomes of ordering that test, the negative outcomes of ordering that test. What's the benefits of the test? It will confirm something you already knew. So it's a rhetorical question, but it's pretty obvious that the benefits of test ordering do not outweigh the harms in this classic primary care scenario. The science for not ordering a test in primary care, the maths and science behind it, are completely clear. It's good medicine. It's not shortcuts. It's not doing the wrong thing. I couldn't have put it more clearly to you. So this illustrates why ordering the troponin in this example is unwise. Okay, it's not just that we'd like to wait and see or whatever. It's actually that it's bad medicine. And this happens whenever the pre-test probability of disease is low. Positive results of investigations are more likely to be false positives, particularly when there's lower sensitivity or specificity of a test. A negative result may only prove something you already knew, and there may be consequences.
It's interesting. So the question is, can you be held accountable if you don't do the test? The answer is yes, you would be held accountable. Therefore, we'd expect to do the test. And I think that is absolutely a fear of litigation, of missing diagnoses. I mean, I think Jared's eloquently talked about the risk versus the benefits. And I think you are putting this patient at risk by doing that test. Are we likely to be held accountable and be sued? My sense is we would not. We would actually be practicing according to best practice and what our peers would do. Based on what you say. Now, clearly, this is probably a much more compelling argument than some much grayer ones where should the test have been done. But I think where we know there's a low pretest probability, the risk, the likelihood that a test is going to be positive means that it's likely to be a false positive, should change the way we think about this, because it is certainly an anxiety for registrars and all of us practicing in a litigious environment.
I suppose that it sort of extends to the other areas, the standard adding of an FBE and a UNE onto a battery of routine screening tests for which there's no evidence. This sort of testing, throwing a net out without any basis, that's not good general practice.
The other thing I don't know that you'll elaborate on, Jared, but just is we talked about epidemiology and that patients who present with this absolutely this same age, same symptom, same presentation, will have a lower pretest probability if they present to us in primary care than if they present to our colleagues in the emergency department. And that's just a fact. And that's a really important fact that registrars need to understand, because patients will self-select to present to hospital if they're more likely to be a serious disease.
More patients who present in hospital with chest pain, the probability, pretest probability of the fact that you're in hospital with chest pain, which is the point you're making, is higher. And so therefore that's not inappropriate. You know, and I think defensible in terms of if you've got a peer as a witness as to say whether they would do it in that circumstance, you know, that would be dependent. I don't want to go down particularly down the medico-legal side of things, and I understand that influences decision. But if you talked on straight clinical reasoning, the science of what we do, that's the case. There are obviously, we mentioned before, there are many other factors, which is why we don't order tests. We take the patient's interests into account. We're practicing holistic medicine, the patient's cultural issues, or there are many other factors that come into place in terms of test ordering. And whenever we don't order a test, when a registrar would order a test, we need to explain our reasoning. And sometimes it will be for the maths and science reason, and other times it will be for other reasons as well. As it was said there, based on our experience, that that kind of problem will generally go, or there are other reasons as well. The point of bringing up this is because it's often quite confronting, and many of us are not really... The first time I saw this from Mark Burgermeister, I was a bit stunned by that realization about those figures. And you know, this is sort of, we're brought up with this belief that a positive result is means something. It does mean something, but it doesn't mean something 100%, and we need to be aware of that. And so a registrar starting in general practice coming from hospital, there's a great article, if you get a chance to read it, With a Grain of Salt by Nancy Sturman. And it refers to, you know, a registrar coming in and seeing their GP supervisor, you know, just not practicing what they thought was good medicine, but it's just that it hadn't been explained to them, the nature of general practice and how different it was. And so it's all strange for them. Without you sharing your reasoning behind why you're doing what you're doing, when faced with uncertainty, they're not going to get it. We do operate in that different, and we shouldn't be You know, there is science to our art. We do take into account cost, patient preference, knowledge of the patient. We shouldn't be ashamed of what we do. It is our high-level expertise, you as Masters of General Practice. That's point number one in how to teach the management of uncertainty. Make the implicit assumptions of our paradigm explicit, why we are deciding to do what we do. So the next point is to normalize the presence of uncertainty. I know it's often been said, oh, we need to be careful of international medical graduates, you know, they're going to not want to lose face, and we spend a lot of time not losing face. I actually think it's a universal culture of doctors not wanting to lose face in front of colleagues by not knowing something or appearing uncertain or not knowing, you know, that it's Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia or, you know, something rare. We do still tend to want to impress each other with our certainty and clinic knowledge. Remember that for the registrar, this may be the first time they've been responsible for making decisions dealing with uncertainty. And so a registrar may not want to reveal uncertainty or that they are a novice learner in this circumstance. And one of the things we know is that this tension has significant impacts on junior doctors' health. It stuns me to see it doesn't stun me anymore, that to know that junior doctors, over the arc of your career, your suicidality risk and your unhappiness with your career is highest as a junior doctor. Medical students, it's higher. Experienced doctors, it's higher. The worst time for mental health is as a junior doctor. And it's because many of them are dealing with these significant changes and, you know, maybe in this circumstance having to deal with uncertainty. So there's a wonderful article by Liz Molloy and Margaret Berman that recommend that supervisors display intellectual candor. That's what they call it. And they say, you need to go first in revealing your uncertainties. You should express, oh, look, I'm not really sure what to do here. You shouldn't continue the culture of certainty. You should make it normal for there to be uncertainty in general practice. That's the message. You know, you don't need to be impressing your registrar with your knowledge. You need to be sharing your uncertainties with them. From that same article, Nancy Sturman's article, many trainees reported coming to accept clinical uncertainty as something they had to learn to live with as general practitioners. But they reported being reassured and impressed when they witnessed their supervisor admitting and managing his or her own uncertainty in front of the patient. Okay, that's a powerful message there, that this is found in focus groups of registrars. And they also commented appreciably on senior general practitioners, colleagues who discuss their own cases with a no one's thinking they know it all attitude, okay, which I think is very important. It's that attitude towards uncertainty that you bring. The other part of this quote, which I want to draw your attention to now, because it leads on to our next way we teach the management of uncertainties. In this quote, it said, the registrars became comfortable with being with uncertainty, provided they knew the process or the steps for managing consultations that were uncertainty and readjusting their perspective to solving problems in general practice over a number of consultations. So certainly sharing that you can do this over a number of consultations, but what are those processes or steps which we use and the GP consultation techniques we use for the management of uncertainty? We use shared decision making, okay, which they may not have experienced that in hospital, a lot of shared decision making. We use safety netting, okay, look, I'm not going to order that test or do anything else. I want you to come back in a week, or I want you to not come back. But if this, this, or this happens, I want you to come back. And we organise follow-up. Registrars often feel reticent about organising follow-up. You know, it's an inconvenience to the patient. They worry about the cost. And is that a normal practice? They don't know. You know, in hospitals, the practice is, of course, send someone away and try and not get them to never come back again. Whereas in general practice, it's the reverse. We want them to come back one more time. So, you know, the follow-up, that sometime educating your registrar and pointing out, you should get this patient back. Did you think you could do a phone consultation? Did you know that we're happy to bulk bill it if it's a phone consultation in that circumstance and if it's going to be brief? You know, circumstances to make the follow-up possible for them. I'm not going to go into those techniques anymore, but in fact, I'll point you to the excellent resources GPSA have written by Simon on managing uncertainty in general practice. There's quite a bit in there on the use of shared decision making and safety netting.
The gap in that resource is that there has been a focus on sort of diagnostic uncertainty, like there's yep. been a focus on diagnostic reasoning. And I think broadening our focus to the breadth of what we do as clinicians, and that's obviously management as well, and is taking a broader focus than just diagnostic uncertainty to management.
from what I shared earlier, it was, you know, I found myself as a supervisor when I would go into the room in an uncertain circumstance, or when a registrar was discussing a case with me, I would think through the diagnostic options, but often it wasn't clear what the diagnosis was and it didn't really help us. You know, as we said, 30 to 40% of the time, we're not sure. And so really, we still have to manage this patient. So my model is about looking at the management options, and we'll go into that shortly. So let's just revisit Murtaugh's diagnostic model, which I think is fantastic. What is the probability diagnosis? What serious disorders must not be missed? What conditions are often missed? Murtaugh loves his classic, could the patient have one of the masquerades? And is the patient trying to tell me something else? Okay, so let's look at our 75-year-old Stephen with his sharp left-sided chest pain and a normal examination. With our registrar imagining going through the Murtaugh diagnostic model, we'd be asking them the questions and seeing what they came up with and helping them with the answers. And what's the probability diagnosis? I'm going to say it's musculoskeletal pain. What shouldn't we miss? Ischemic heart disease, PE, thoracic aorta dissection. And what conditions are often missed? What might be a pitfall? Zoster would be a classic. Could the patient have one of the masquerades? Could be depressed. Is the patient trying to tell me something else? I did want to say he didn't want to do the dishes. You know, he was getting the pain leaning over doing the dishes, maybe. But, you know, obviously there's an exploration of social history and circumstance of what's going on, why he's presenting with this particular pain at this particular time. But then, as I pointed out, even when GPs don't diagnose, we still manage. And in the paper that will one day get published, I use a quote from Roger Naber, from the guru of British general practice, the inner consultation. And I love this quote. It says, and this so much speaks to the general practice experience, if to some problems we can attach a formal diagnosis, that's a bonus. What we must always do for every problem, diagnosed or not, is decide what to do about it. And that's what led me on to realizing when I was going in and speaking to my registrar in front of their patients or in a teaching session, that I was always exploring, well, what could we do? Let's look at it by what we could do. And I broke them down to 3 R's. There's nothing rocket science about this. Probably many of you are doing it already without realizing it, but I've just decided to make this as a model to help remind you and to realize what you are doing when you are doing it. So when you're faced with uncertainty, what can you do? You can just review and reassure. Someone pointed that to me, there's another R there. And you know, that is usually the first and best option. So before you review and reassure, you've got to see, is a wait and see strategy safe? You know, have they got crushing chest pain, clutching their chest? Probably not a review wait and see strategy is not safe in that circumstance, but there's a significant likelihood of something going on in the meantime. And if you are doing that, what safety netting is needed? And there's an opportunity there for you to get your registrar to say, well, what safety netting instructions would you give to this patient? They get to role play, to rehearse the safety netting instructions and how they would put it to the patient. So that's option number one, always the main option. The next one is refer. And you think about, well, what pathology or imaging tests or other special tests might be informative? And which non-GP specialist or allied health practitioner could you refer to? And to be honest, when I come to that section and I can't think, which classically it is, I mean, if you look at this example, you're kind of thinking, what pathology or imaging tests? None of them leap at you strongly. And but am I going to refer this person to a cardiologist? No, they're going to end up on the treadmill. They're going to have an angiogram. They're going to have every test done before they're all the nail to their hammer. So if I can't think of something, it's usually reinforcing that I need to do a review and reassure approach. The final R is an RX. You know, what treatment could be used? What treatment might be helpful? Often, to be honest, that's a delaying tactic again. But also, might treatment aid diagnosis? The patient's got a cough. Well, maybe we could try a bit of Ventolin to see if that helps the cough, in which case that's a trial. So I'll go through the 3 R's. And we're going to go through them individually. Review is the best option, is the default option, if the other R's aren't clearly the best option. And I'd also say, if you can, stretch out doing 1 hour at a time. Don't do all 3 hours. That's a way of using time. Let's look at our example again and look at it through the 3 hours of management rather than the Murtaugh diagnostic model. How would this play out? This would play out that review and reassure. Is a wait and see strategy safe in this circumstance? Yes, it is. What safety netting is needed? pain on exertion, or perhaps I didn't write it in there when I was looking at it again, maybe constant chest pain or more severe chest pain, or the development of a rash. You know, this is an early presentation of herpes zoster, so that might be safety netting which we're giving in that circumstance. What path or imaging could we think of? Well, we could probably think of a chest x-ray. I wouldn't think very strongly of it based upon that history, or a thoracic spine x-ray or something. Definitely not troponin for the reasons I've shared with you earlier. What specialist or allied health practitioner could assist? As I said, I don't think a cardiologist, I don't think an orthopedic surgeon would be very useful here, a rheumatologist, maybe a physiotherapist thinking that it's musculoskeletal pain. What treatment could I consider? Oh, okay, maybe some non-steroidals or some paracetamol might be useful. Might the treatment aid diagnosis? Not really in this circumstance. So what's the outcome then of this uncertain case after we've used MRTAR and we've used the 3R model? So Stephen is told that the mostly diagnosis is musculoskeletal pain and it will likely just resolve. He is reassured, because you've had this conversation perhaps in front of him, that heart disease is unlikely, but told to attend to review if he's pain on exertion or if he has constant pain, if he starts to develop a rash. The plan is to wait and see if the pain resolves, and if not, review, referral to a physiotherapist is likely the next step. Saying there are only four things a GP can do: reassure, treat, investigate, refer. Yeah, I've just combined exactly what you're doing into 3 hours. Yes. Yeah. And as people say, it's very familiar. I think, like a lot of things, when presented to you, you go, well, I was actually already doing that. I'd already come across that myself. And this was just me reflecting upon what it is I do as a supervisor and trying to put it in a way that I could share with colleagues.
How have you used this in a teaching way? How do you, apart from you can describe this, but are you wishing for this to become a subconscious and a registrar to kind of no, almost step through it each time?
I actually like to make it explicit that I'm using this 3R model and I share it with them, because I think it's actually something that they can use in future when they no longer have a supervisor to discuss with. And it's something I still use in practice sometimes, and often with a patient. Patients, you know, when you do that thing aloud with a patient, well, you know, you often do that, you know, when you're doing a shared decision making, you not only discuss the diagnosis in the shared decision making, but, you know, where it's appropriate. I mean, it's not judging when shared decision making is appropriate is another fine art, but, you know, well, I could do this, or I could order that, I could do that. And oh, the person expresses a strong view one way or another about what they want. So I won't use it explicitly revealing the framework with a patient, but in terms of with a registrar, I will share the framework, hopefully because it'll help them to remember to use it, just as MRTAR provides that diagnostic pause to stop that premature closure, makes you think, okay, what's most likely, you know, what do I not want to miss, what masquerades, what to think in that way. I think this way is just to remind you of those options. For many of us, presumably they do come spontaneously to you, but where they haven't, it's just to reflect, oh, okay, what tests could I do? What are my options? So to explore the management options. I hope that answers you how I use it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and if people say, I realise I've been doing it subconsciously, I think many supervisors have. A bit like when we first started to introduce random case analysis, Simon, we found a third of the supervisors said, oh, yeah, we're doing that already.
Yeah.
So it's many, many a good idea really is already out there and being used.
And so a lot of this is really just, I think, boiling it down to its core elements that make it a bit more understandable and accessible for a registrar who, because this seems so commonsensical, but for a registrar coming out of the hospital environment who's suddenly faced with uncertainty, this is can be incredibly useful to just have three letters to kind of hang their hat off when they're thinking, what on earth do I do here?
And the importance of making review the first option.
Yeah.
You know, I know one of our colleagues, Sam Hurd, often reminds people about how often, you know, things which you see once and it resolves spontaneously. It is a very, very common thing. And often, you know, what is going on there? The person's got a concern, a fear about a particular condition. They come in, they present in a strange way. Their anxiety is making it difficult to assess what's actually going on. You offer some reassurance in that time and magically the condition goes away. The doctor was the drug and we shouldn't be afraid of using ourselves in that way in that circumstance.
I was thinking of Tim Chappell, and one of the most memorable quotes of his was, run towards the wave. where he's talking about difficult patients, but I guess in a sense, difficulty can be uncertainty and confusion and challenge. And maybe that's another in somewhere in there, another R, instead of running away from it, Tim's phrase, to you're running towards the issue.
And I hope by having a model, and as it said in that quote from Nancy Sturm's paper, having a model, knowing the steps, knowing what to do, reduces their anxiety, helps them to accept that this is part of what we do. We don't achieve a diagnosis, we use time, we use review. This is normal general practice. For all of us, it's quite normal. It's nothing revolutionary. For a registrar, it is, and seeing it happen. So I'm going to go over my conclusions. So managing uncertainty is at the core of what we do. Our special sauce is more science than art, okay? It's actually not something wacky. It's something based in maths and science. And where it isn't, where we're making decisions for other reasons, for our knowledge of the person, for our holistic care, for being patient-centered, we should be making that explicit as well. Why we do what we do and not be ashamed of it and think that it's inferior or lesser medicine. Our approach to test ordering highlights our different science. We should normalise uncertainty. At any chance, share your own doubts rather than your own certainties. What you're uncertain about is probably best to lead with rather than what you're certain about. We use consultation techniques such as shared decision making, safety netting and follow-up, and you need to teach those to your registrars and help them make their way through them. That's a lot of role play there in working your way through that. So explore diagnosis using Murtaugh's diagnostic approach and explore management using the three R's. So what next? Have a crack. Use these strategies with your registrar. The GPSA resources, which I said, other than not having the three R's, are fantastic. And in fact, I must admit, when I came to writing my paper, I mean, I read through most of the references which you'd garnered there, Simon, and on in that section on management. I'd certainly very fascinating reads. So there are some GPSA resources to use. Unfortunately, this paper, which was accepted for publication in August or so last year, is not due for publication, I'm told, until next year. There's a real backlog in Australian Journal of General Practice. So, but when it comes out there next year, you'll say, oh, I remember that one all that way back.
Jared, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Simon, for the opportunity to speak and share my little passion here on the management of uncertainty and the three R's. Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks so much, everyone, for your contributions. Great to have you along, and we look forward to seeing you. All the very best. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Thanks for listening. We'd love your feedback. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please give us a rating and or a review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast with your colleagues. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest a topic, you can reach out to us via our social channels. Simply search GP Supervision Australia on Facebook, Instagram or X, formerly Twitter. GP Supervision Australia is supported by funding from the Australian Government under the Australian General Practice Training Program.